It's Friday, June 5th. Okay.
You ready? You ready to rock and roll? Okay.
Ready to
so
go.
Tim had another meeting he had to go to today, so he asked me to fill in. So sure. Here we go. First question comes from Anne. She says, I'm working on a mystery. Obviously, the killer is the antagonist. Spoiler alert for Anne's book. But after listening to an editor's roundtable of the podcast yesterday, I think the real antagonist is what I'm calling a culture of silence that allowed sexual assault as the normal behavior by men or people in power. The assaults carried out by someone led to a lot of secrets that eventually led to a murder. I feel culpable because I'm on the roundtable. God, if it's like something I've said that confused someone. Sean, can you talk a bit about writing a work in which the force of evil in society is the antagonist and various characters take turns embodying that role?
Sure. Let's see. My general thinking about adding, hold on a second, I got to sort of adjust my, I can't really, can everybody still hear me? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, good. All right. So when you are trying to embed social commentary, there's a mistake that early writers make all the time. And that is, it's a phrase that I'm reminded of that Robert McKee uses all the time. It's to be on the nose. And to be on the nose means that you're directly stating social doctrine inside of the story, and it doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is that the best way for these deep truths to hit the experiencer of the story is through their own internal processing. So it's very tricky because you want them to understand the grand social systems and the culture that enables sociopathy. But if you start saying things like, he came from a long institution of predatory behavior that happened in the Justice Department, then it just seems like, oh geez, what is this, a soapbox? So I speak all the time about specificity, and it's been my experience then that when you are so fully invested in the specificity of the on-the-ground action, so the primal genre, that action story that has that structural scene componentry of those 20 elements that I laid out in the latest Beat book, I think that's a really good roadmap to harness your energy when you are literally writing. So the society genre itself, when you set out to write that kind of story, like when George Orwell did when he wrote Animal Farm, you can see, or at least I can intuit, I bet he didn't necessarily figure out to use an allegory using anthropomorphic animals until he had struggled talking about Stalin and Trotsky and all that shit. And he probably got to the point where, like, you know what, I'm just gonna lift all this crap off of it and tell the story of what happened with the Bolshevik Revolution over a period of 50 years. And instead of getting locked into the personalities of Lenin and Trotsky and blah, 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 I'm going to put it into a world that I know well, which is the English countryside and a farm. So he was able to bring the specificity of his deep understanding of the social degradation of the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, he was an expert in that. And he was also an expert on living in a small farm in England. So whenever he wanted to probably drop in, you know, deep historical stuff, he probably said, nobody cares about that. Let me focus on these animals. So to get back to how you, in a mystery crime story, embed social commentary, it's actually the way you do it is to not worry about it. The way you do it is to deeply connect with the, you know, here's something that should be useful, is to think about power hierarchy and growth hierarchy. And I write about this in one of the beats, but I think this concept and this tool is very, very helpful, especially today. Because what I think we're facing today culturally is the breakdown of a institutional system that has been in operation since the end of World War II. And that institutional system sort of got this steroid injection in 1989 or 1991 when the Berlin Wall fell. And the structure I'm talking about is the hierarchical power structure that is market-driven based upon efficient market theory from the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman, Hayek, etc. And basically what the power structure means is those with the money win. It's a zero-sum game, and it also reflects back on game theory in the Cold War and John von Neumann's sort of theories about the individual as a selfish machine. Game theory is an extraordinarily powerful concept that has taken over subconsciously all of our cultural systems. So the power hierarchy, the way it stands now, is everybody sort of talks about, let's get real for a minute here. How am I really going to reach the top of the New York Times bestseller list? All this stuff about process and everything is really nice, Sean, but let's get real. What I want is the power of being a New York Times bestseller. So let's get rid of all this stuff you talk about, you know, thematically, and process and all that stuff and this growth stuff. That's nice, but I really want to get on the New York Times bestseller list. Let's get real, right? So when people start talking like that, our initial reaction is like, oh shit, they're right. You know, we can all, you know, feel good about ourselves in the quiet of our own room, and maybe we can get a little bit smarter and cognitively process better. But it really comes down to getting that New York Times bestseller, because that's really all that culturally the majority of people care about. And I say that's bullshit. I think that's one half of what makes us human beings. So game theory was about how can we figure out a way so that we don't blow up the world? And so they had to think about game. What's the game? Well, the game is, will the Soviet Union want to blow us up so that they can take over the world, or can we blow them up proactively before they get as powerful weapons as we do? So this thinking became all about how to stop the grab of power from another superpower. And game theory, for what it was, became this idea of mutually, I forget the middle word, but it's an acronym, MAD, MAD, mutually assured destruction. So the way they figured it out is, let's just get in an arms race. Because if they know that we're monitoring them 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, through planes and through silos, and they know the second that they hit the button, we're going to launch our stuff, then it's this, it's called the Nash equilibrium. The Nash equilibrium is these two power forces just stop, because they know if I hit the button, they're going to blow me up too. So that's like game theory at its highest level of exponential thinking. And it worked. It worked because there were only two superpowers. Now that other people have them, it's not going to work any longer, because we can't monitor the way we used to be able to monitor, nor can the Russians. So when you're talking about power hierarchies, you're talking about the game theoretical first principle that everybody's selfish, everybody's a selfish player. There's scarcity of resources, and we're all competing with one another to get while the getting's good, because there's only so much stuff to go around. And if I can grab Leslie's stuff while she's not looking, then I get her stuff and I win. All right, so that's called the having mode. I must have things. It's desire. It's Girard theory about, you know, the desire for want drives conflict. All right, so that's the having mode. Now, what game theory forgot about was this other evolutionary adaptive thing that human beings are really good at. And that's called cooperation. And cooperation is about understanding that we can all do better if we work together. So that's all of, like, all of us have this need to be part of something larger than ourselves. So we want to contribute to the body, the cognitive super consciousness of our species. That's embedded in all of our DNA. Now, game theory did not even approach that very, very critical part of our humanity, right? So this is the paradox of being a human being. We want to have a New York Times bestseller, but we also want to contribute to the greater good. So it's this back and forth. It's this opponent processing that we all face all the time. So usually what happens for me personally is when I'm locked into my growth stuff, a bill will start coming across my desk, right? The gas bill for all the showers my kids take for 45 minutes will cross my desk, and I will say, let's get it real here, Sean. You got to bring in some income, right? So it's this, okay, let me do that. And then you go back, and then you go back, and then you go back, and you go back. But game theory only put forward, we're all selfish assholes, and all we care about is ourselves. And the John Nash equilibrium. Now, John Nash, they made a movie out of his life called A Beautiful Mind, which was a complete whitewash of his entire life. But anyway, John Nash was this brilliant guy, but he was also schizophrenic. He was a paranoid schizophrenic. And he had to go into a mental institution for about 10 years. Now, what's the one feature of a paranoid schizophrenic? They think everybody's after them. So he came up with this idea of the Nash equilibrium in game theory, which is mutually assured destruction. And he put forward that the Nash equilibrium will work not just for the arms race, but it works for the economy too. If we throw away any kind of regulation for the economy, eventually we'll hit an equilibrium where everybody's selfishness will start to balance each other out. So I'm so selfish, but Leslie's selfish too. So we have conflict, and then it reaches an equilibrium. But there are winners and losers in that idea. And this is like Darwinian, you know, social Darwinism, which is a horrific concept that has been pushed on all of us since we were born. Anyway, my point is, what we're facing right now is this liminal place where that sort of game theory, we're all selfish players in a big game where there's scarce resources, has come to a crisis moment, and it's fragmenting. And we're all of our very, culturally, a lot of people are rejecting it. And they're saying, you know, this isn't cool. There's a lot of winners and losers for no real reason other than really ridiculous reasons that don't make any sense at all. So so it's kind of, it's exciting, but it's also like, you know, what's that expression? The event horizon. The event horizon is that point in history when you don't know what's going to happen next. And it makes human beings extraordinarily uncomfortable, in crisis. We're all burning massive amounts of calories because it's just psychologically disturbing to be alive right now. But it's also incredibly exciting. But it's very, very, it's like, you know, walking a razor's edge on a mountain cliff. So when you're looking at a crime story or a mystery story, and you want to inject some of the stuff in there, there's a couple of ways to do it. The speech and praise of the villain is always a wonderful opportunity to get to a place where you can make some really interesting social commentary, because it's coming from either the antagonist or directly from the antagonist, or it's coming from the, say, the investigators. So the investigators, you know, it's like that moment in the movie Apocalypse Now, when Martin Sheen, the Colonel Willard character, is reading the dossier of Colonel Kurtz. And it's a brilliant, I mean, it's a brilliant moment, because he's, just a moment. Because he's giving us a rundown of this man's life. And we start to sympathize with Colonel Kurtz before we ever see him. So in the speech and praise of the villain, you can do that in the context of a mystery crime story by having people just go, shit, we can't figure this person out. They're doing this and they're doing this and they're doing this. It seems to be so random, we'll never be able to figure it out. And why are they doing this to the victims? And why is that happening? So all of this investigative back and forth and dialogue serves as a means to actually talk about the real sociopathology within the culture itself. When we discuss serial killers, we all think it's this third party mad person who's gone off the rails. But the truth of that is that those investigations are investigations of our very culture, because every culture has its own sociopathology. And like one of the things in the Soviet Union that was sociopathological was the everyone was reporting on everyone else. So there was this constant surveillance pathology where people were reporting on their next door neighbors because they coveted their apartment. And if they could get them sent to Siberia, they might be able to get their apartment. And it became, and there was such scarcity in that culture that it was like, report on someone else or they're going to report on you. Very game theoretical. But our our pathological and to have a serial sadistic, let me just like make one distinction between what I mean when I talk about sociopathology and a sadist. Someone who's sociopathological is open to the necessity of doing something extraordinarily unethical, immoral, in order to further their goal, right? So they're open to it. It doesn't mean that they're employing it. They may employ it, but when they do employ that sociopathology, that immoral or unethical tool, they're doing it as a means to an end. So a sociopathological person isn't necessarily a sadist, okay? So there's a lot of people in politics who are sociopathological. They say things that they don't believe, which is unethical and immoral in my estimation, and I think in most people's estimation. Misrepresentation of your core belief system in order to attain a goal is unethical and immoral, and it's not a good practice. Anyway, that's my sermon for today. But all right, so that's a sociopathological figure, someone who will use immoral or unethical means to get an end. Okay, a sadist, the actual pain of another person or another body politic is the point. They actually thrive. It's like glucose for them is to experience someone else's pain. They like to watch other people in pain. And that's the point. So they could not care about getting a brand new car. They just want to see somebody in pain, and they enjoy that. So when you're writing a crime or a mystery story, the difficulty for the investigator, and this is why you always sort of see the investigator and the antagonist are in the same arena. You know, we feel like they're, but for the grace of God, shall the other go? And that's representative of the sadomasochistic elements within our culture, is that, you know, a good friend of mine from college became a police detective. And he, you know, I always said to him, well, you must have like some deep, you know, fascination with death. And he was like, oh, you're crazy. But, you know, there he was every night, any homicide that would come, he would get the hell out. You know, he had to get to that scene. And he was a really good police person, but he had a death wish. And I think he kept putting himself in situations that were extraordinarily dangerous because he was attracted to sociopathology and sadism, but he didn't want to really, and nor should he have probably, he didn't really want to investigate that fascination within himself because he was able to say, I'm the one doing the good. I'm putting the bad people away. I'm right. So when you're doing a crime story, that's something to think about. And the specialty of the criminal investigator. So say it's a special victims unit kind of person who's dealing with horrific sexual sadism. There's something to think about while you're presenting that person And it's a way for them to cognitively expand by, and Thomas Harris did this so brilliantly in Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, where the investigators, quote unquote, as sick as the killer. And Thomas Harris was a crime beat reporter for years for the AP, and he's rarely interviewed, but the last interview I read about him, somebody said, like, where do you get your ideas? You know? And he's like, I don't know what you mean. Like, well, where do you get these ideas about these sicko killers doing these weird things? And he said, everything I write is true. And you would be shocked at the behavior that people do in real life. So it's not that I invent this stuff. And you could just tell at that point, he had made a mental note, never doing another interview again, because to be so naive to believe that he invented all of these very strange things, he just didn't really want to play that game any longer. But anyway, back to the question. Not a good idea to consciously put social stuff inside of the story. Focus on the specificity of the sociopathology and the sadism. It doesn't mean you have to get disgusting and with all kinds of crazy details, but also think about, where is my investigator on this spectrum of sociopathology? Are they barely hanging on? Because then you get the vigilante cop, or, you know, who believe that they're above the law, and then they kill the killers and they feel justified, but they're also getting a hell of a thrill out of it. And that's really a hard thing. And we as readers get a thrill out of that too. So we have to identify that within ourselves too. And especially when we're creating this stuff, and it can get hairy, but it's worthwhile. All right. Sorry. Next question. Sorry. Again, another 28 minute answer.
No apology necessary, I guarantee you. Jewel is asking, if one of the purposes of story is to help us better navigate reality, what stories would you recommend to help us navigate this significant moment in our collective reality?
Oh, what stories to... to deal with what's going on right now. What's remarkable about what's going on right now is that there are so many domains that are entering liminal territory. Meaning, when I say liminal territory, I mean the systems that kept them stable seem to be fragmenting and breaking down. And the most difficult one for me personally to navigate is the information system. I really think that we're in the midst of a war, and it's a war of information, and it's destabilizing all of our ability to make sense of anything. So the landscape for war has usually been an external landscape with guns and bombs and fronts, in the last sort of, I think there was a cognitive leap in technology in the last decade, 15 years, that has weaponized information technology to the point where it's impossible to separate the signal from the noise. So when that occurs, it's difficult because we feel like we don't know the truth. We can't find reasonable sources of information that we can rely upon to let us know how to best handle the situation. So the stories that the battleground has become an internal battleground, and I think each one of us is it's going on in our own minds. So the stories that are helpful in these times for me are first principle kind of ideas. It goes back to just basic Plato, Marcus Aurelius, the Buddha, all this stuff, like I was talking about earlier, when I was saying, well, we're a divided animal and we want to survive. And I think I was writing about this the other day. I think there are three perennial problems that every individual experiences that move up the chain from the individual to the couple, to the family, to the larger group of family, to the tribe, to the town, to the blah, to the... So all of these levels, they're like these little mini circles, they keep expanding. And I think all of these circles face three perennial problems. How do we best survive? How do we best thrive? And how do we leave something worthy, meaningful behind? Those are the three things that I focus on when I get flooded with stuff that I can't understand. So how do we survive? That's the having mode, right? How do I get enough resources in order to continue my life? How do I make the lives of those who are closest to me, how can they survive, right? All right, so cool, we got to deal with that. That's everyday life. That's being real. The second one, how do we thrive? What's thriving all about? Well, thriving, in my estimation, is about finding meaning. So how do I find meaning? Well, what's my primary concern, as Paul Tillich would say? What's the thing? And I'm old enough now, thank God. I really feel sorry for anyone under the age of 20, and anyone probably that extends to 35. Because I didn't really know what the hell I was doing until I was probably about 40, 41. So my ultimate concern had not been revealed to me until I was about 41 years old. And since then, I feel like, okay, when shit hits the fan, I just write some stuff about storytelling. I explore it some more. I think about this. And then I share it. And I hope somebody finds something helpful from it. So the ultimate concern is what floats your boat? You know, what keeps you from jumping off a bridge? You know, like, okay, this is it. And then how do I leave something behind? It's, okay, I've got my ultimate concern. How do I share that ultimate concern? How do I expand the domain of my ultimate concern in such a way that it grows cognitively and I can leave a little fraction behind such that someone in the future might stumble upon this thing, this artifact that I've created, and say, shit, that was helpful. And you can, these three things, I think if you're say you're a union organizer. Like that was my father's ultimate concern. And he lost it. He lost that ultimate concern and then eventually killed him. But when he was in that world, he would go to rallies. He would go to the steel mills and he would fire guys up and say, we got to do this and that and the other thing. And that held him together. And he found a lot of meaning in that. And then it fractured. And I think he wasn't capable of abstractly thinking about, I'm a union organizer. What does that really mean abstractly? That means I work to help people who are not being properly served by our culture find the power and the strength to seize the day. So that's kind of that's a really important thing too. But I'm not a union organizer. And I'd like to be. I really would, because I think it's so fucking important. But it's not what I can do best. So somebody said, everybody has a little, it's like the Beatles thing. Everybody has a little weight they got to carry. You got to know what you're fucking carrying on your back. And you carry that weight. You don't carry somebody else's weight. So your job, I think, is to find your ultimate concern, your vocation, and work your ass off to move forward and contribute something. You know, have the courage to say, fuck it, I'm shipping it. It's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. You know, it's going out there. And I'm going to start the next one. And I'm going to work on this. And so the stories, that's, in my estimation, that is the heroic journey. It has nothing to do with seizing a gift from another culture and bringing it back to your tribe. I think it's about answering those three problems that bring meaning. If you find meaning and you passionately work to spread the meaning that you found, that's a righteous life. And when you have the opportunity to pull somebody else along who's not getting a chance, you do it. And, you know, there are so many, Shelley Speary, one of her favorite books, probably her favorite books, and she shared, you know, you can just tell whenever she writes about the fire next time. So I think about, you know, that book. That's a great one. Invisible Man's a great one. Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is a great one for this time, this specific time. There's just so many, To Kill a Mockingbird, anything that can remind us of, it's just, we all have the same DNA. Each one of us is separated by a nano, like maybe a couple of base pairs, really. So all of these things that are so explosive right now are at their foundation. They're like Dr. Seuss, you know, this is silly shit. You know, star-bellied Sneetches. If you've ever read that book, it's all you need to know about who we are. So yeah, that's it. That's all I got for that. All right, let me change my thing here so I can hear. Okay, I can't just hear anymore.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
I can. Great.
Okay, good. We just did an episode on Ragtime on the Roundtable podcast. It hasn't aired yet, and that's the one that came to my mind.
That's a great one.
It's going to be a good episode too. You should all listen. We've got another question here from Kathy. And by the way, those of you who are on the call, if you do have questions, feel free to put them in the chat. So Kathy posted this question in advance. In one of the episodes that you did with Anne Holly, the Masterwork Experiment on the Flagship podcast, you discussed different types of lovers meet scenes. Lightning strikes was one of them. Are there other types of lovers meet scenes?
Oh, sure. There's tons of them. There's the, I can't stand this person, get them away from me. That's usually a great lovers meet conventional idea. I'm trying to think of an example of that one, but there are plenty. The lovers meet scene is really, I think when you try to externally manipulate it into something like, I've got an idea, they're going to meet at an amusement park and they're going to be on this roller coaster ride. When you start externalizing and sort of coming up with these really intricate settings, you can lose the thread of who these two characters are. So the beautiful part of the scene from Terms of Endearment was that we had two very lonely people. And two very lonely people so locked into their persona that the persona kept them apart. So Aurora, her persona is a very, very meticulous, thoughtful, proper person who has a tight control on her libido. And she has a very, very, you know, strong will. You can tell she's just not someone you want to fuck with. You know, she's gonna rip you apart. And Shirley MacLaine is so good in that. So that's her persona. But she also has a very, sexy side to her. And she's very interested in sex because she denies so much of it from her experience. All right, so you got that, this really incredible atomic molecule on one side of this fence. And then you've got the guy who has sex all the time because he can. And he was an astronaut. And he's going to milk being an astronaut until the day he dies. But he also knows it's meaningless. And that the conquest, once that's over, it's just, you might as well be shaking hands, is a famous quote from The Graduate. So he's locked into his own persona, which is all about conquest. And there's a sadistic side to it too. He's a devilish figure. So she's attracted to the devilish figure because he's probably pretty good in that department. And he's like, oh, that's a nice looking woman there. Let me see what I can do. And so it's not until those two things slide away are they able to actually have a real connection. So my point is that when you think about these two, think of them as molecules. Like, how are they going to come together in a way that's meaningful? And that's a really cool, metaphor, because that's what built our existence, are molecular things coming together and sharing electrons. They're sharing a thing. And it's those things together that bring life to the world. So when you're thinking of lovers meet, think of them like, I've got two hydrogen elements and I've got oxygen over here. How am I going to bring them together? How are they different? Well, you know, oxygen is pretty, you know, it's pretty stable. Hydrogen is all over the place. And that's what you had in that scene. You had oxygen and this hydrogen coming together. So when you're trying to figure out how am I going to make these lovers meet, you know, it's almost like challenge yourself. Just give yourself a generic setting. She's in the backyard. She's sad because her daughter just left town. She's never coming back, probably. She's all alone in that big house. Her husband's dead. And then this asshole next door is screaming, jumping in a pool. There, that's your setup. Go. And then, you know, she's like very prim and proper, but she can scream, you know? She can let it go. So think about your two characters, and then the innovations will rise from those molecular beings, as opposed to trying to come up with a meet cute. You know, that whole Hollywood, old Hollywood thing was you always want your lovers to meet cute, like in a laundry, you know, in a laundry shop or whatever. Okay, next question, if there are any.
Yes, we got one that came in on the chat. This is from Megan. She said, speaking of embedding your message with things that you know, I keep getting this little voice from my work in progress asking me to give my leading man a particular flaw. I've never read a book that has a leading man with this flaw. I resist making the change since I'm afraid I will have to go out and read dozens of books to see what has been done before, pausing my drafting. Is it okay to trust the muse and run with it and rely on beta readers familiar with the trope to tell me if my interpretation of the flaw is tired?
I wouldn't be able to answer that perfectly unless I knew what the flaw was. My general thinking about anything that comes to you like that is like, it's not, you don't have a choice. You know, because it's something within your subconscious is saying you've got to put this flaw in there because you need to explore it. And yeah, maybe you do have to read those 10 books. Maybe you do have to think about it. And the other thing is that I wouldn't be discouraged. Like, how many leading men have an intimacy problem, right? Like all of them. So if you were to go, well, should I have my leading man have an intimacy problem? No, that's been done before. No, it's what, how does this intimacy problem display itself? What's the pathology of the thing? How do they cover it up? Like a lot of leading men are damaged, you know, some really bad shit happened to them. And, you know, they're just, you know, very circumspect about who they open up to. And we see that all the time, but it's the reason why we see it all the time is because it's true. It's true. And, I don't want to get into any like gender stuff, but another thing to do is to flip them. That's like, and I think Ann and I talked about that on that series, but you know, put the traditionally leading man thing on the woman or the partner or whatever. So just switch them so you think that that can be interesting too. But generally, you got to go with an inspiration up until a point. And then if you kind of get to the point and you're like, you know what, I've milked this thing and it's just not working. And, you know, sometimes the ideas are great and sometimes they're not, but you at least have to give it a try.
Okay, are there any more questions from you guys who are on the call? Going once, going twice. No, that seems to be it.
Great.
Thank you, Sean. Have a great
Thank
weekend.
You all.
See if you can take a few minutes off.
Yeah, that's right.
Bye.
Bye.